WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Global corporations are becoming the world empires of the 21st century, according to a new book, Global Dreams: Imperial Corporations and the New World Order. The international reach of these corporations has created a global shopping mall, a global workplace, and a global economy. So if you want to understand what's happening economically, culturally, and politically, you need to understand this new corporate system. Here to help explain it is John Cavanna, a trade expert with the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author with Richard Barnett of the book Global Dreams. 20 years ago, Barnett wrote one of the first books about multinationals called Global Reach. I asked Cavanna what he thinks the major differences are between the multinationals of 20 years ago and the global corporations of today.
Big companies today, because of changes in technology, can move production virtually anywhere. 20 years ago, it was really only the clothing companies that would stick sewing in Mexico or in the Philippines, or the electronics companies. Now it's virtually anyone, any of these companies. And what it does is it means for more and more Americans, they are part of a global labor pool. Their job can be taken by somebody else. And so it has increased the levels of anxiety. It's also increased, there's been enormous job cutting by these big firms now that you didn't see 20 years ago. 20 years ago, these companies really were the pillars of the American economy. They paid the taxes, they provided the jobs, and today this is much less the case.
So 20 years ago, the multinationals were good for the tax base in the United States, but are global corporations paying less taxes in the United States as they headquarter more, move more around the world?
U.S.-based companies are paying an awful lot less taxes here in the United States. It's partly because Ronald Reagan was very good to them and cut corporate tax rates, but it's equally because they've become increasingly ingenious at declaring their profits in countries where tax rates are low. So, and this is, in some ways, this is, I think, the fundamental challenge that we face in the next decade or so. Governments are trying to take care of their people's welfare. They're trying to raise money for healthcare and other programs. They're trying to provide jobs. And yet the most dynamic economic actors in the world today aren't national. They're stateless. They have no allegiance to the U.S. One of the executives we quote in the book comes out and says, "Why should I care about the U.S. trade deficit? Doesn't affect me." And so you have the problem that these corporations truly don't care where they create jobs and where they pay taxes. And that creates tremendous problems for governments and for the rest of us.
Yeah, well, as you point out many times in the book, we're living in a world of nation states and global corporations.
Right.
So what do you think is the changing relation of global corporations to their home governments?
Well, I think that, and again, some historical perspective is useful. I think 20 years ago, well, certainly 50 years ago, most companies were very nationally based, if not locally based. And the same with banks. They would produce in the communities where they sold the goods. Banks would borrow from people in the community, and they would lend it back to people in the community. What has changed is that the opportunities now for global profits often mean that that kind of relationship no longer makes sense for the companies. And what we've really seen is a breakdown in the kind of relations between companies and communities and workers, where there used to be more of a symbiotic and a sympathetic kind of relationship. Now, the bank, you'll go to your local bank, you'll put your money in the bank, and that bank will see tremendous opportunities to make money off your money by speculating on the yen or the Deutschmark or investing in Chile. And there's less and less money available for your community. And the same, so when you go in to get a mortgage, there's less mortgage money for you. The same is true in terms of jobs. It used to be that companies felt more of an obligation to provide jobs in the community, and now they don't, if they can produce it as cheaply in Mexico. And keep in mind, this isn't just factory jobs. This is a secretary's job, where now the work is faxed or sent via satellite to the Philippines. There's simply those bonds have broken down. And it really, we are worried about a kind of disintegration of those bonds, which really held society together.
Well, in your book, you write that corporations have a greater role in the electoral process around the world than at any other time since the 1920s. And you say this is nowhere more clear than in the United States.
Yeah, what we're talking about here is that companies, I referred earlier to the fact that they're paying less taxes and they're providing less jobs. You would think that their influence, therefore, on politics would go down. What is remarkable is that it doesn't, in part because these large corporations know that sympathetic regulations at the national level are vital to their success. So they spend a great deal of time spending money on politicians. In this country, it's done largely through PACs, where political action committees, where they give, they are the biggest contributors to candidates for office. In other countries like Japan, it's more subtle. We I think, have a case in there of a politician meeting with a corporation and getting a shopping cart full of yen and large paper bags. It's done in different ways in different countries, but part of the reason why the political system, which should so much more be trying to fulfill the needs of local workers, of local communities, why it still caters to these companies is because they're still the big contributors.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Cavanna, co-author with Richard Barnett of the new book Global Dreams, Imperial Corporations and the New World Order. Right now, we might be on the verge of a trade war with Japan. The United States is putting the squeeze on Japan and threatening to punish certain Japanese industries unless Motorola is given the access to the cellular phone market in Japan that it was promised in a 1989 trade agreement. What's your interpretation of this?
Well, this new pronouncement by the U.S. government is based in two things. First, it is Bill Clinton needing to look tough overseas. He's not looking so tough right now in Somalia or Bosnia. He needs to look tough, and Japan is a place where he can look tough. But there is an underlying economic reason, which is that over the past 20 years, Americans have become far more addicted to Japanese goods and services than the other way around. We love their TVs, their VCRs, their cars, and we are buying on average about $50 billion worth of goods, more goods from Japan than they're buying from us. So that's what's beneath it. Now, whether or not what Bill Clinton is trying to do will get to the root of the problem and get more Japanese buying U.S. goods or get less Americans buying Japanese goods, I do have some doubts, and for the following reason. It has everything to do with this whole issue of stateless companies. Actually, a lot of U.S. firms went to Japan right after the war, IBM and others, Coca-Cola. They have been producing and selling in Japan. Or if you take another big company we deal with in the book, Philip Morris, which owns Kraft, they're selling Philadelphia cream cheese in Japan, but it's made in Australia. And they're selling chocolates in Japan, but they're made in Italy. And so part of the problem is that U.S. firms are actually doing quite well in Japan in many instances, but it's not benefiting the United States because the goods aren't being made here. So it's not benefiting U.S. workers. And on the other side of the ocean, the Japanese have had a much more coherent policy of encouraging their firms to produce at home and then export. So we are in a relationship, this bad relationship, in part because the Japanese government and Japanese corporations have been much smarter in the way they produce and export in a way that's good for Japanese people. We have been much less smart, and we have a policy which is good for these big companies, but not so good for the U.S.
What kind of regulations would be possible to make it more likely that what benefits the global corporations would have some benefit for their home country, the United States?
Well, part of what we think is needed is a kind of global New Deal. doing on a global level what we did here in the United States 50 years ago during the Depression, where when firms at that time were going from being local to national, they were doing the same thing we now see on a global level. They would play union states off against non-union states and rich states off against poor states to try and bargain down wages and working conditions. And we had a long fight, and we passed a series of regulations that I think most people now think are essential to the well-being of our society. Regulations around health and safety and around a minimum wage and maximum hours of work. Well, today, 50 years later, we are at that stage globally. Firms are doing that globally. They're playing our workers off against workers in Mexico and in the Philippines and increasingly in China. And yet there's no global set of rules. So that's the sort of thing we're calling for. We, for example, during the NAFTA fight said, here's a beautiful case. Let us take this trade agreement with Mexico, which is giving all these new rights to corporations, and let's put right in there basic rights for workers, basic environmental standards that can't be violated. And if Ford is violating them in Mexico, there should be fines or there should be trade sanctions.
Why would, for instance, developing countries want to reach some kind of agreement that would make it more difficult for companies to locate in their countries and bring jobs to their people?
Well, the way we've put it is that these new agreements, like the North American Free Trade Agreement, in fact are 21st century sets of global rights for firms. They give them all kinds of new rights to move where they want to. And if you combine that with 20th century rules for labor and the environment, you get a kind of 19th century capitalism. You're going backwards, and we're all being bargained down to the lowest common denominator. This is, I think, what has really changed, and this is what is the thing that is most fundamentally new and challenging, is that the Ford Motor Company now can put exactly the same factory in Mexico or China and get the same cars and the same quality, yet pay 1/7 the amount. And as long as they can do that, they will be bargaining down U.S. wages and working conditions. I think part of why the sort of global rules we're talking about are inevitable is there's a built-in fragility to this kind of globalization I'm describing, which is that if you're constantly chipping down people's wages and you're constantly cutting back on jobs, you're not producing the people who can buy your goods. We interviewed the head of the Ford Motor Company, and he said now, today, the world's car companies have the capacity to produce 56 million cars, but there are only 45 million people in the world who have the capacity to buy them. And so this is the interesting point. Ironically, it's in the long run interest even of these companies for workers to be able to make enough to buy the stuff that they're producing. But in the short term, cutthroat global competition, they still push those wages and those benefits down. And so that's why we think it. I think more and more people, not only in the government side of things, but even enlightened people in the corporate community, are going to come to the realization in the next few years that we need a new global set of rules.
My guest is John Cavanagh. He's a trade specialist at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of the new book, Global Dreams, Imperial Corporations and the New World Order. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Cavanagh, co-author of the new book, Global Dreams, about global corporations. You know, there's two big business stories in the news today, or at least two.
Right.
One has to do with trade relations with Japan, and the other is that Paramount and Viacom are merging. What does that mean in the context of global corporations?
Well, a lot of the book we've written focuses on this fascinating new area of global culture, the fact that more and more the main U.S. export, our most successful export, is of our own cultural products, our movies, our magazines, our books, our videos, our music. The takeover of Paramount by Viacom will create an even more effective global corporation in the culture field. And so, and it's interesting, this is the company that owns Simon & Schuster, which produced the book that we're talking about right now. I imagine in the long run, it will help the globalization of the book. That's the positive side of things. It's interesting because a lot of what the book is it's trying to demystify what this global village is. And our basic conclusion is that in this culture field, in the field of Paramount and Viacom, there is a global village. We are getting music and movies and so on. The American dream is being spread around the world in many different ways. But for most of the rest of the world, there's a kind of two-tier society emerging. Yes, they can see the great American dream in Paramount movies, but as much as two-thirds of the world really don't have access to the goods. They don't have the money to buy the things. They don't have access to bank finance. And they're largely window shoppers in the global malls that are spreading around the world. So a lot of what we're seeing is the spread of a global village where the people who are hooked in, and that's perhaps the top third of the world's population, are getting a lot of benefits, but the bottom two-thirds are out. And that is splitting societies, and it's splitting the world, and it's creating divisions, which I think will be major social problems in the years to come if we don't address this in a new and innovative way.
You know, one of the great paradoxes is just as we're seeing the rise of the global corporation, we're also seeing a rise in nationalism. So the nation state is becoming more nationalistic as the corporate world is becoming more international. Is this coincidence or are these two phenomena related?
It's a very strong relationship. Part of what has happened as corporations have become global is that they have undermined the ability of governments to do their jobs. Everywhere governments are finding it harder to collect tax revenues, everywhere governments are finding it harder to produce jobs. And in fact, corporations, by going global, have dismantled a lot of the regulations that corporations once had over them. I think that when that happens and times get tough economically, people have a tendency to turn inward and turn inward to their own problems. And if nations aren't solving things, if Yugoslavia wasn't solving things, or if Canada isn't solving the problems of people, people get nasty and they turn inwards and they say, okay, we'll have a Quebec country that can do this, and we'll have a Bosnia, and we'll split up the Soviet Union. It's, in my opinion, it's not going to make things any easier. It's going to be just as tough for these smaller states and this intense nationalism to create yet newer states. It's going to be as hard, if not harder, the smaller these units get for countries to manage these problems. But I think it's a natural kind of reaction to people feeling out of control and feeling that larger governments aren't doing the job that they used to be able to do.
From your perspective, NAFTA is going to benefit global corporations, but offer very little to American workers, that it's going to make it harder for American workers because it's going to make it easier for corporations to move their plants to other places. Do you think that labor was shut out of the NAFTA debate?
Labor was totally shut out of the NAFTA debate. And it's fascinating because labor helped elect Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton, in his campaign, came out with a statement that has helped me realize that he does understand these dilemmas. He said, if I become president, I will renegotiate parts of NAFTA. I will put in tough labor and environmental standards. I think what happened was he came in, he put into place these very conservative economic ministers, Lloyd Bentsen and Mickey Cantor and others, who actually were going to negotiate the final stages of the agreement. And they didn't believe in labor rights or in environmental standards, and they froze out organized labor. So yes, they were completely frozen out, and the final agreement is not even close to the original promise that Bill Clinton made.
In a lot of ways, the whole global scene is leaving labor behind. Do you think labor is keeping up with what's happening? Do you think labor needs to regroup, refocus, reprioritize, change the concept of the labor union?
Yes, absolutely. Really, we all need a kind of global rethinking. But for labor, The challenge is, I think, twofold. It is one that with this new globalization, there's a lot more unsolid jobs, a lot more temporary jobs, flexible jobs are sometimes called, where it's very hard to organize trade unions. Trade unions need to be much more innovative in reaching out to people who aren't part of the old traditional large factory workforce. But secondly, and equally importantly, and this has begun, trade unions need to reach out across borders. So that, for example, right now between the U.S. and Mexico, yesterday, two U.S. trade unions, the Teamsters and the electrical workers, filed petitions in conjunction with Mexican workers to NAFTA, to the NAFTA panels, saying that Honeywell and General Electric had violated the spirit of NAFTA in firing workers who were trying to organize, and they're bringing complaints. And this happened through joint U.S. and Mexico labor activity. So I think it's vital that trade unions change the way they've been thinking about the world. And let me just end by saying I also think it's vital that consumers do as well. I think 5 years from now, consumers hopefully will have the choice to buy products with a clearly identified seal that makes it clear that those products were produced under conditions which respected environmental rights and standards and labor rights and standards, so that consumers, who are ultimately one of the most, the potentially most powerful citizen force in all of this, can have a much bigger say in steering these decisions and in steering global corporations in the right direction.
Is that the bottom line for you, that it was produced by a company that respects the rights of workers and the environment, as opposed to the bottom line being made in America?
Absolutely. We are not going to turn the clock back on globalization. Companies will move around. And the key, as long as we can push for and guarantee the rights of Mexican or Indonesian workers, they will be able to push their wages up as productivity goes up towards our levels. And the kind of pressure we feel in the United States will go away. And that's what's so fundamentally new about this era, is that what is good now for U.S. workers and for U.S. communities is the same thing that's good for global communities. It's not just a moralistic argument that you need to help workers in Mexico. It is now in our economic self-interest.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
John Cavanagh is co-author of Global Dreams, Imperial Corporations in the New World Order. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.